trying to predict the future is not the best way to prepare for future threats. Instead, the Defense Department should focus on becoming a master at responding to new, unforeseen challenges. That's according to Lieutenant Colonel Dan Ward, U.S. Air Force retired. He's author of Fire, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. He's my guest on Pentagon Solutions today and writing about ways to speed up the Pentagon's acquisition response time and innovation. Dan, welcome back to the program. It's great to talk to you again. You write about a book called The Non-Nuclear Defense of Cities, and you point out that it's a little bit quirky. Tell me why it's quirky in your world. Thanks for coming on, Dan.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here. I really enjoyed the chance to chat with you again. I came across this book, The Non-Nuclear Defense of Cities. It was published in 1983 by Lieutenant General Daniel Graham. And he basically, in this book, laid out the idea for the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Star Wars program that was aiming to help protect America from basically Russia's nuclear weapons. Kind of a quirky book, the Non-Nuclear Defense of Cities. I think that's an interesting title. And it sort of is based on this assumption that cities are what we need to defend and that the default way for defending these cities is nuclear weapons. So in the piece, I say that, Lieutenant General Graham was absolutely right to say mutual assured destruction was a poorly conceived policy. It was a bad idea, and we needed to replace it with something better. But what he didn't know when he wrote this book in 1983 was that the Soviet Union would be gone in less than 10 years. And it just sort of made me wonder, what do we not know? What new changes are coming down the road for us today as we talk about the future of war? We know technology will come and go, threats will come and go, but the specifics of that are awfully hard to predict. And I think his book is a great example of really some of the best thinking in that area and how it still sort of fell short of understanding what the future was really going to hold.
You're participating in an effort at the New America Foundation called The Future of War, and some of the thinkers that are involved there are thinking about exactly the same things that you're writing about in Defense One. We have a link to your piece at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. That concept, and I think we've talked about this before in terms of acquisition and procurement, but the Pentagon is, as I said, notoriously bad at predicting the future because, for the most part, the criticism seems to be that we're preparing for the last war rather than the next one. How do you break out of that and into a mode of preparing for something the terms of which we may not even be aware of?
Sure. That's a great question. And I would say pretty much nobody is good at predicting the future. Somebody said there are two types of predictions. There are lucky and good. It's very hard to predict the future. So I say we don't need to get better. I'm sorry, lucky and lousy are the two types of predictions, lucky and lousy. We don't need to get better at predicting the future. We need to get better at quickly responding to an unpredictable future. And to expect that the future should somehow suddenly become predictable, I think doesn't bear up well under the data and under the experience. One of the cases I make in this piece and others is that the tactical ability to rapidly develop and deliver advanced new technologies is itself a strategic advantage, and that being able to quickly respond to new changes as they emerge, things that we didn't see coming, but that we can respond to quickly, that's better than trying to polish up the crystal ball and get really accurate about what life will be like 10 or 20 years into the future.
So how do we build a structure like that within or on top of the structure that exists in the Defense Department right now, given its size and the width and breadth of the missions that it undertakes?
Yes, I think it needs to be within and alongside of. And actually, going back to General Graham's book, he pointed out that he says there are plenty of precedents and examples of how to deliver advanced new technologies on shorter timelines with less expense and less complexity. And some 32 years later, after his book came out, we have even more examples and even more methods, even more principles and practices for how to rapidly innovate, how to reduce the time associated and the cost associated with doing this stuff. So agile software development is one method for that particular type of technology, but there's a whole range of other things, and I go into some of them in my book.
Dan Ward is a non-resident fellow at the New America Foundation and a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel writing in Defense One. And you write about this book by General Graham. Even his book bemoaned the, quote, "This the acquisition cycle's more than doubled in length since the 1950s. And the departments have been unable to implement all the measures they themselves recognize as required for rapid and cost-effective system acquisition. For not knowing that the Soviet Union would go away in 10 years, he certainly was able to predict 30 years into the future what the acquisition system would look like inside the Defense Department, Dan.
He did, and that critique, that commentary sounds very common or very similar to what people are saying these days. But what's interesting is he says, you know, the departments have been unable to implement the measures that they themselves recognize. We know what we need to do. We have precedents, we have examples, we have the technology and the procedures and even the regulations to reduce the cost, reduce the schedule. You know, but for some reason, we've had a hard time actually putting that into practice and doing what we know needs to be done. So there's a significant number of people out there trying to take different approaches rather than just a policy approach, maybe focus more on culture change. And rather than just focusing on the technology piece, it's more about how we develop that technology and how we field it. You know, we'll see if 30 years from now people are pointing back to a piece like this and saying, you know, hey, it sounds like what 2045 is like today. So hopefully that won't be the case. Hopefully we'll be able to push things in a better direction.
Dan, you write at the end of this piece, the secret is to find and follow the good examples, and you cite the Virginia-class submarine in the Navy and the Air Force's MC-12 Project Liberty aircraft, and to build on the successful precedents of those who went before us. It turns out the keys to future success just might be found in the past. Why is it so hard to look at a program at programs like those two? Jack Gansler cites the JDAM missile program on an ongoing basis. Why is it so hard to look at those and say, well, we're going to build the next bomber that way, or we're going to build the next whatever it is that we need that way?
You know, in large part, it comes down to an issue of imagination and an issue of incentives. I think both of those sort of play into this scenario. When I say imagination, I mean we need to be able to look at something like the Navy's Virginia class submarine program, which came in tens of millions of dollars under budget and on the order of, you know, a year ahead of schedule for a nuclear powered submarine. That's an amazing accomplishment. But we need to be able to look at that and say, oh, you know, I bet we could do something like that as well. Oftentimes, we fail to hit those marks because we don't even try. We think, oh, well, there was something special about that sub. There's something special about those people or that technology, that organization, and I couldn't even try to imitate that. And in fact, we oftentimes could. Same thing goes with the MC-12 Project Liberty aircraft. So there's the imagination piece, but then there's the incentive piece. There's, you know, sometimes we look at those and say, I could do that if I wanted to, but I'm incentivized to do the opposite. It's better for my career, better for my promotion chances if I, you know, manage a cast of thousands and spend decades and billions than if I come in under budget and I deliver early and under ahead of schedule. Again, so it's how we have structured our incentives, and really a lot of it comes down to what we think is possible.
So the incentive part sounds like the one that would be the easiest to change, because that would involve just putting different rewards, and I don't just mean financial rewards, but putting different career rewards, as you alluded to, and so on into place. The imagination part of it seems like that might be the one that would be the tougher pull.
Sure. So with the imagination part, and in large part, one of the ways we can sort of tackle that problem is by telling some of these stories out loud and saying, here's what has been done, and if it's been done before, it could be done again. As far as the incentives, in fact, my impression is that a lot of those incentives actually do exist. Like, it does look good on your career. It does look good on your record if you say, you know, hey, this project I just led, we were $8 million under budget. We delivered several months, or we delivered a year ahead of schedule. That's the kind of thing that does look good on acquisition professionals' record, on their transcript, on their resume. But I think there's also the sense that managing a multi-billion dollar program also looks good. And so I think we can incentivize both, and we sort of do incentivize both. And a lot of times we sort of take the easy way out and say, well, you know, I'll go ahead and be part of this huge cast of thousands and be on a big, expensive, complicated program because I know that will look good, as opposed to sort of taking the chance of, hey, what if we have this high-speed, low-cost thing? You know, will people really value that? And I think the organizations that are associated and that are involved in this kind of work can and often do value that. And it really, I guess, it comes back to the imagination piece. Can we envision a scenario where people are rewarded and incentivized for delivering early and delivering ahead of schedule. I don't find that much of a stretch, but I know some people do.
Do you have a sense that the budget limitations the Pentagon is dealing with now and for the foreseeable future will force some imagination that otherwise might not have been forced?
I do think that there's a good chance of that happening. You know, one of the things I read about in my book is how constraints foster creativity, that when we don't have a lot of time, when we don't have a lot of money, the obvious solutions are sort of taken off the table. We can't do things the traditional way or the expected way, and we're forced to find a new and creative way to do it. And so, you know, well, certainly the budget cuts are uncomfortable, and maybe they could be more thoughtful and more effectively managed. They are forcing us, I think, forcing the Pentagon to move in a direction of trying different things, coming up with creative solutions, and hopefully those will be productive creative solutions, and you know, not sort of shortcuts that will end up biting us later.